Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show. It's Saturday, January 6, 2007, and I am very glad this year to say in a non-pro forma way, Happy New Year. This is our first show in 2007, and we have four guests. I'll introduce in just a second, but I point out that this show takes place barely 48 hours after the convening and the inauguration of the 110th session of Congress. We've been waiting for this since even before November 7th and the historic midterm elections. And we've been looking towards the potential that we have, and that is our topic today. What are we making as the new politics and the new economics in 2007? Now, I'll just to underscore that, I heard that just a few hours ago, Senator Harry Reid, now the lead senator of the Senate, was giving the Democratic Party response to President Bush's weekly Saturday show. And Senator Reid put it this way: "This week we began a new chapter in America's future." So our guests today are here to discuss where things stand, how it looks for humanity, for changing course out of what we have been having under the Bush-Cheney regime and those private anti-nation state backers of this regime, and how we're going to overturn this and in a revolutionary way. So I will introduce the LaRouche Youth Movement guests first, because we definitely have wanted someone from Washington, D.C., and we're glad to have Ed Hamler on. Welcome, Ed.
Hello.
Who's been there all week, right, Ed, as Congress convened and events took place, right?
We got here, I think it was Wednesday at 3 in the morning. And
okay.
So we've been here since then.
Good. So we're going to come right back to you, because I'll just mention otherwise from the LaRouche Youth Movement we have out in Detroit, we welcome Joel Moise.
Hello.
Hi. And I'll tell everyone that Thursday, just a couple of evenings ago, Joel was among those who organized a terrific town hall meeting about the new opportunities, new politics for 2007 right there in Detroit, and is going to speak about what's involved in that. And from Boston, the LaRouche Youth Movement, we have Ivan Korpis. Hi.
Hi.
And here in the studio, my colleague in economics for Executive Intelligence Review, I guess I should say I'm Marcia Mary Baker, and I am moderating today, but we welcome Paul Gallagher. Hi.
Hi, Marcia. Ready to go.
So the lines then, one way to look at it, have been drawn ultra clearly between, I was mentioning the bad guys before, in Washington, D.C., between those who you could call the economic hitmen, like George Shultz and Felix Rohatyn, each of whom had articles this week in major national syndicated press about what they want for the new year. George Shultz was co-authored something with Henry Kissinger and other people on how we have to control nuclear power, control nuclear weapons. Felix Rohatyn, on the nominal Democratic side, wrote an article reprising what he did in the 1970s to ruin New York City under Big Mac, and said we have to look forward to private financial interests running nation states now in the new year. Forget that. What we have on the other side, on behalf of humanity, is Mr. LaRouche wrote a document, a policy document, on the occasion of the convening of Congress called What the Congress Needs to Learn, the Lost Art of the Capital Budget. And you can't summarize something like this, but it really is on how we will need to act on behalf of developing nation states and citizenry. And I just point out to everyone that this is going to be, it's already available to you. If you haven't looked at it, look on LaRouchePub.com, or you can look on Mr. LaRouche's Political Action Committee, LaRouchePAC.com. And preprint of this, because this is appearing in the print version of the weekly Executive Intelligence Review that will be dated January 12th, and it will be out this week, was distributed to Congress as they gathered this week, and others in Washington. So let me just then stop there. And Ed, why don't you describe, if you arrived at 3 a.m., but what's been happening in Washington? What do you think what do people need to know about the opportunities and also any downsides?
Yeah, well, I think, the situation is really wide open. Before we got here, there was a discussion that we had with the war room because one of the reasons a few people from Boston came down is because we were involved in an intervention where I think it was about 40 of the new members in the House attended at Harvard University. This is the new members of Congress conference. And we had found this just for looking for different kinds of things to intervene in, and surely enough, everybody was there. So we found out ways to intersect these guys, and this was sort of more of an intelligence operation than it was just sort of bumping into things. But nevertheless, we managed to intersect these guys in two ways. The first way was with the chorus, which was very effective, and we actually had to find these guys in the building that they were having this conference. And we did that, and a lot of the congressmen enjoyed that. But the major intervention we had was an event where there was a reception for the new Congress, and that meant that all of the congressmen were, you know, having snacks and drinks and so forth with the students of Harvard, some of which didn't really even know about this. And it wasn't an event open to everyone, but this was a political necessity, so we figured out how to get in. So this intervention really served as a way to get the first reading on the new Congress. And the reading that we got was that these guys are a lot different than the general sentiment that you get from the 109ers. It's centered around people who have no experience in politics. I mean, that is, you've got like high school teachers, for example, you know, from teaching in high school being elected to the Congress, and similar kinds of people, just working class people, people that were largely not supported by the Democratic National Committee, Howard Dean types, found themselves in a position where they recognize the challenge of war, continued war, and the economic crisis was why they were elected, and primarily elected by youth. So this was the first sort of reading that we've got. So, I mean, we who were involved in that in Boston, came down to D.C. because the new Congress just had their receptions and parties this past week. They just sort of getting acquainted with D.C. They have, you know, these transition teams that are supposed to acquaint them. But really, to characterize the work that we've already done, I think, I can't really do it in one word, but what I will say is that the entire environment in D.C. is completely different than what we're used to. We're used to coming down to D.C., and there's a certain kind of, you know, fight and so on that you have to put up with. But there's a very interesting kind of freedom that people are smelling sort of in the air. Now, some of the things that have been going on in terms of particular things is what I mentioned, that there were a lot of these receptions for congressmen, parties. Actually, the Senate had bigger parties. And we found that in discussion with...
More space.
Yeah, right, more space. There's less, you know, less of them, right? But we found that we said, look, let's take what we did in Boston, right? We already got a sense of what these guys are about, what they're thinking about. Let's escalate. So the idea was we're going to challenge these guys on two fundamental things, right, which is the impeachment of Cheney. That's got to be number one on the agenda. And there's all kinds of weird discussion around that in D.C., but that has to be recognized as a very strategic challenge that they have, and it's not really optional. The second thing is what Lynn put out recently as his report on the capital budget, because this is really a challenge of principle, a challenge of understanding necessary principles to create a future. And that is, I mean, definitely one of the things that the Congress has to begin to understand. So we went in with those, you know, sort of objectives and sparking that kind of discussion. And, you know, it was very good because the entire environment, I mean, everybody was really giddy except the Republicans. You know, the Republicans, they didn't really want to talk about anything but football, you know, the whole day. So, and the only, I think the only disgruntled Democrat I saw was Howard Dean. He didn't, for some strange reason, he didn't seem too happy about the festivities, but I guess we can talk about that later.
He might have read some of the recent EIR report beside his direct experience.
Well, he may have let his buddies Felix Rowatin down. You know, they may be taking it out on him. You know,
yeah,
you never know.
He's in trouble.
but what we found is that the entire Congress, I've never seen the Congress so happy and optimistic. And, you know, you get the general thing from, you know, certain staffers. Well, you know, we can't talk policy now. But a lot of people actually did want to talk. Even people, we met a lot of people that worked on particular campaigns that were from the district. We did talk to a lot of staffers, and we talked to a lot of congressmen themselves. So during the beginning of the day, and Wednesday or Thursday, during the beginning of the day, you had a lot of these receptions. So what we did is we just went in to spark up these kinds of discussions with people, and we found a few interesting things that went on. A lot of people were open to discuss the deeper questions underlying the particular tasks the Congress has to do. For example, I know Matthew here ran into a group of students in the halls of Congress, and they were there because they just were excited too. They were happy and they wanted to, you know, greet the new Congress and so forth. And we immediately got into a discussion on what we were there for. And this broke out into a discussion about Plato and universal principles and right in the halls of the Congress. So as this whole discussion is going on about Plato, here's this congressman walking by, and, you know, he listens and he slows down. And then he stops, and his neck's sort of behind his body, and then he has to turn around to engage in this discussion about Plato in the halls of the Congress and why this is this is necessary to understand physical economics. I mean, and this went on for, I think, over a half hour, something like that, with these young people. You had other discussions with staffers, to similar effect, and this never goes on in the Congress, okay, in the halls of Congress. So that's the kind of thing we found to begin with, that there's a very, there's a lot of openness, despite the kind of party atmosphere, to get into deeper questions, even involving Lynn's capital budget concept. We found a lot of that. That's mainly in the House side. On the Senate side, we found some very interesting responses to the question of impeachment, even by some Republicans. Some of our organizers confronted some of the congressmen because apparently in the Senate, at Jim Webb's party, at a big party over there, and there were just a lot of senators there. It was so big, greeting him, congratulating him. And we had a chance to talk to some of these senators, some of whom were Republican, and, you know, we confronted this Republican senator on the question of impeaching Cheney first. How do you like the sound of President Cheney? Right. And going through the political necessity to do that, and there was indicated to us by this Republican senator I just put it this way, that that's being worked on, so to speak. So there's a complete shift. And you also see with the discussion around the Iraq surge, a lot of Republicans joining the Democrats against that. So this is just a complete transformation. And I know amongst the new members of Congress also, a lot of their plans center around, for example, in one New Hampshire office, a return to a space program approach to job creation. Right, it's a discussion that, you know, some of us have had at the Harvard event and also in D.C. And a lot of the staffers of these new representatives, they remember our work and they know what we've been doing, and they said explicitly that they've some of these staffers that have been there for a while have always appreciated our work, and they were happy to have us celebrating with them. So this, there's a lot more I could say. I mean, there were also parties at night. Were you getting the same thing? One interesting thing is that Webb's reception, not in the Senate, but he had one before that in Virginia for his, you know, friends and locals to come to and so forth. And, you know, the entire night, we were getting in discussions, serious discussions with people about the kind of principles Lynn is saying that people have to understand around the principle of negentropy and economy, why that's crucial for understanding how to create a capital budget that is focused on the development of infrastructure, taking into account the development of the biosphere and the creative powers of people, things like that. This was going on all night. You had a huge fight that Wesley Irwin had with some person that works in the government. I'm not sure if he's a staffer. I think he's on one of the committees. But around the question of musical tuning, A440 versus 256, and then getting to the principle of scientific method, which led into a discussion on economics between Malthus and Hamilton. So I can go on, but I mean, the kinds of quality of discussions that we're now able to get into reflects this general sense of freedom and optimism that people have. Even if, I mean, the Malthus guy was kind of crazy, I mean, to say the least. He said some other things which I won't say here, but needless to say that this is the kind of thing that's going on. Now, there was also, just I think to give people a sense of this idea of the new politics that LaRouche has been discussing and the old politics, then we can come back to some more of the congressional things if people have questions. But this was yesterday. There was an American Enterprise Institute event where John McCain and Joe Lieberman spoke, and they spoke on the question of the Iraq surge and their support of that and pushing that. And we were there, and we were there first. We had set up a chorus. We had signs that said, "Impeach Satan first," and it had a picture of Cheney.
By the way, let me just break in here, Ed. I want you to continue. That was the question I had ready. In front of me is the translation of the German website of Der Spiegel, which is a little like Newsweek or Time rolled into one. And they're reporting on just what you're saying, Ed.
Right, right.
Your chorus was there. Here's the quote. "A chorus sang with pictures of U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney around their necks, 'Impeachment for Satan,' it read. And it has the full-color picture on the website showing a picketer carrying your sign, 'Impeach Satan first,' with Cheney depicted as Satan with his two horns," right? Is that all accurate for a change?
That's pretty much accurate.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I'll come back to some more of the congressional stuff, but I think this is indicative of the same quality that we're getting. So we were set up, and then there was another group that came. I think it was a group with Move On, and there were some other groups collaborating with them to protest this surge. And so we were there. It was about, I'd say, 15 of us, with some singing, some distributing. And I got to be frank, what they tried to do, because we were in the middle of the entrance where people would go in and come out, so, you know, we could get them literature and sing and so forth. So what these guys tried to do, the other protesters tried to move us out and push us out and so forth. So what they did was they had enough people to have these roving marches on each side of us, sort of walking around in circles, like,
oh, yeah,
like pickets.
Picket lines.
Yeah, picket lines. And so as this was going on, you had this guy on a bullhorn, and they were saying things like, you know, hey, hey, ho, ho, surge policies, you have to go, or something like this.
The Spiegel says, no Iraq escalation.
Yeah, you had that one. You had, hey, hey, you know, McCain isn't, surge policy is insane, you know, these kind of things, and they were yelling this. So we began to sing a few different things. We, you know, we sang Dona Nobis Pacem,
oh, no.
O Freedom, No Nobis Domine, and also a lot of the political canons that we put together. And this, I mean, at first glance, some of us were apprehensive because these guys were very loud and bullhorn and everything. But we kept going, and what we saw at a certain point, we saw people from their lines in our chorus, and their mouths were moving, but they weren't chanting; they were singing the songs that we were singing.
Uh-huh.
And these were older people; these were baby boomers, people you wouldn't really expect to do that. You had a few youth that joined in too. And at a certain point, you had literally like 10 of these guys in our chorus, and just every song we were singing, they would be there. And even this was a funny thing, because we magnetized the two roving pickets, because, you know, you would have to walk around and pass us every time you came around. And so as these guys were passing us, they would slow down the entire picket so that they could hear us. And then we had to speed up and rush to get back around.
Sort of like an orbit.
Yeah. We were the
non-circular.
You were the perigee.
Yeah, we weren't the equant. I think we were the perigee, right? But you had this effect, and people that wouldn't really take literature before wanted to be brief, wanted to know what we were doing, why we were doing it. You know, this is beautiful. You know, what's LaRouche saying about this? Now, you know, I remember him from a long time ago. He's got a youth movement. So this was great. And even the sort of operatives who tried to push us out had to begrudgingly thank us after the thing was done.
And that's great.
Made contacts and spoke to a lot of the people that were in the AEI event, got a chance to brief them and so on.
Well, that's a real nonlinear effect.
Yeah, and you had a similar thing at the Capital South Metro Station when the the Congress was being sworn in. You had a lot of these old crusty boomers holding up their signs, yelling and stuff. And then when we started singing, started requesting songs and, you know, saying that I know this one, so they wanted to sing along. So this is the kind of thing you're seeing, complete transformation.
Well, that's great. I wonder, there are two lines to follow here, and also you all can pitch in back and forth between Boston here, Detroit, and Washington at any time. Go right ahead. But before we have about 4 minutes till we have some program announcements at the half-hour break. And so let's pick up on this quality of organizing, because maybe from Boston, where there's something to be said about what's been going on there with Ivan, mm-hmm. in the same kind of nonlinear way, what you've been doing over the holidays, and so, because campuses are now open, there's a whole what the mood is. And then we do want to get to ask Paul, too, about this congressional aspect of what's coming ahead, looking ahead a bit. I didn't say right at the beginning, but January 11th, that's this Thursday at 1 p.m., is the Lyndon LaRouche International Webcast, and it will be on You can look at www.larouchepack.com. On the old economics is dead and the new economics must begin. But, Ivan, what do you want to throw in here?
Well, like you said, we had a lot of success with a lot of satirical Christmas carols that we were singing all over Boston, just in cutting through some of the Christmas schmaltz and bringing people to bear on the fact that, this new Congress is right around the corner. I mean, once the new year hits, we're in a real downhill kind of mode where the changes are going to be happening very rapidly. So it was important to be out there on Christmas Eve and in the weeks preceding so that people would be thinking about this over their holiday break. And in the same way, we've continued the same intensity of work with the chorus and these, extended sectional rehearsals, really emphasizing proper bel canto technique. Because it's no longer just a gimmicky kind of, you have a deployment to the field and a chorus is kind of compulsory. But now, the chorus itself is really striking to people, and the beauty is a real irony for people to contend with. I mean, what is this movement? What principle is creating this kind of cultural change that people are having to bear witness to on a daily basis? So in addition to that and our excitement in bringing that kind of choral work down to Washington, I mean, we're just chomping at the bit here, drooling over the opportunity. We've also witnessed a real surge in recruitment possibilities, which is entirely lawful when you're dealing with a non-linear kind of transformation in a political situation. I mean, we have contacts who we haven't talked to in 9 months who are, kind of creeping out of the woodwork and coming by our office and singing with the chorus, investigating the new astronomy, Kepler's work with us. And it's very exciting to see genuine optimism and in the population.
Oh, that's a good – thank you very much. Let me just then say these very few things now. This is the LaRouche Show. It's January 6th on Saturday, 2007. We are weekly on Saturday from 3 to 4 in the afternoon Eastern Time out of the United States. Those of you who are listening by telephone know that on the website is where you can participate in the show. You can hear it live, and you can send emails. There's still 30 minutes more if anyone wants to email in. We'll put it to our panelists. And that is www.larouchepub.com, LaRouchePub.com. So January 13th is our next show. But I say again, January 11th, which is a Thursday, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, centered in Washington, D.C., will be Lyndon LaRouche's first New Year webcast in the midst of this new 110th Congress and new possibilities. The title is The Old Economics is Dead and the New Economics Must Begin. If those of you who want to check into more specifics about this can go to Mr. LaRouche's website for his Political Action Committee, which is LaRouchePack.com, LaRouchePAC.com. And otherwise, those of you who want to telephone at any time, who may be listening here by phone, otherwise you can use the Inside the United States toll-free number, which is 800-929-7566. I think this historic excitement that has just been described in Washington and in Boston also raises that those of you who want to get involved, resources will lead to even more excitement. We want to spread it in the new year widely. So contributions, involvement, donations, this is the time. And definitely new prospects, new things are in the works for your electronic form of EIR, EIW. It's actually EIR online. I'm showing my age. EIR online. So let me just say this. Before I want to I'd like to turn to Paul Gallagher, who's also a segue to Detroit, Michigan, because Paul, along with others in the United Auto Workers, with Joelle, who's waiting on the line in the Detroit office, has worked for a couple of years closely with Mr. LaRouche and with Capitol Hill and with people at large for emergency intervention to stop the deindustrialization going on. And Paul, could you give a reading of what you think we need to know, but what shape you think things are taking in the way of new hearings that are already in the works, or what we might expect and also contribute to, what people should orient to?
Well, I was really listening with great entertainment to Ed's report. I was also going to offices that same day, and one of the things I saw was an Imitation Limb chorus at the Capital South Metro. That is, somebody else was imitating them in the middle of the day on Thursday, indicating that it's becoming known that this is a tactic that works.
These aren't just buskers. These were people consciously.
These are people with some political cause. Okay. We didn't stop quickly. Okay. but it's becoming known that not how to do it, but that if you can do it, it works. What struck me was almost 2 years ago now, certainly a year and a half ago, LaRouche's FDR legacy, the prolegomena to a party platform. He started that by saying that he was determined to make the Democratic Party the party against globalization, the anti-globalization party. Now, that seemed a big stretch at that time, but I'm sure that Ed and others who have talked to these freshmen, and I didn't talk to so many of the congressmen, the new congressmen themselves on Thursday, but to many, many people around them in their offices, and they tended to be not only staff members, but often you'd meet their parents and their in-laws and their close friends from back home, who would give you a kind of a picture of what the congressman really would like to do if he could, and particularly when it was announced that Harriet Myers was resigning that afternoon. I happened to be in the office of a new congressman from Pennsylvania, and everybody that I was talking to simultaneously started saying, "That's the beginning of the drums for impeachment. That's gonna," and they were naming that congressman and saying, "And he's going to play a role. You watch. He's a demon investigator. He's going to play a role. We're going to get these people." So there was a lot interesting. It was a very interesting day, with particularly in these new offices. But the anti-globalization is the anti-free trade is the self-conception of the economic policy of many of these new members of Congress. They campaigned on that. They really believe that they have to do that. Similarly, as soon as the question of great projects of infrastructure, Apollo projects, is brought up, they also are for that. They understand that that's got to be done. The party has already put itself in a bind on this by passing the so-called pay-as-you-go or pay-go.
That was just passed, right?
It was passed on the very first day as a rule, not yet as a law, but as a rule in the House. And it's heading in the direction of trying to get it passed as a law in the House and the Senate. It only pertains to pay-as-you-go pertains to entitlement programs, not to discretionary spending, to so-called mandatory spending. But they're talking about spending caps, which is the way they dealt with the discretionary program after the 1997 agreement. So with that already being put forward, they're baffled as to how they could approach this question of infrastructure, of real jobs, of saving the jobs that they know are disappearing in the industrial base, which are the good jobs, because already fiscal responsibility, fiscal austerity, really is being put forward as the overarching necessity. So there's fascination with the idea of the capital budget, that the Congress has to break this connection between the fear of debt and fear of high-interest federal debt on the one side, and the necessity of job creation, infrastructure, reviving industry, reversing deindustrialization on the other, which seemed to them so irreconcilable now. The way they have to do it, it's like a really like a light going on that the way you do this is by returning to capital budgeting under the Hamiltonian credit creation rules rather than the PAYGO rules, the Hamiltonian rules of creating credit under the American system over the long term, over generations, for purposes of exactly Apollo-style projects of infrastructure. So this I really think is the big discussion. Now, this is not simply a matter of the interstices of receptions in the offices. This is going to come on the floor in hearings, I think before the end of January, that the whole condition of the economy is going to be on the floor in some of the hearings. I know that in the past weeks we've discussed the oversight hearings on the war, the so-called war on terror, the oversight hearings on the violations of the Constitution and the lying about intelligence in the Bush administration. But at the same time, and perhaps even earlier, there are going to be serious hearings on the condition of the economy and the banking system in a number of the relevant committees in the House. And that's where the issue of the institution of a capital budget for infrastructure building is going to be wide open. So let me just leave it at that for now, without discussing the collapse problems they're also going to be confronting. But that's what I think is their intention, and it's up against what they think is a noble intention, but is already boxing them in, which is this idea of we're going to be fiscally responsible. We're going to match every increase in spending with either an increase in taxes or a cut in spending somewhere else. You know, this was the thing that was sold to them during the Clinton administration. And, you know, it was part of a bubble. It was part of a strategy which was building up the IT bubble in the 1990s. So that they don't see a way out of that until the capital budget is broached. It's a very, very powerful idea, and it really moves some of them.
Well, let me there are two threads here we wanted to make sure and bring out before the show concludes, and we do have over 20 minutes. But one of them, let's come back to with Paul and Ed, about how much you perceive people really see the breakdown process, or they still have delusions. I'm talking about in the monetary, financial, and economic situation. But first, so we'll come back to that. Joelle, you're out there in Detroit on the same day, last Thursday, that Congress, the 110th, was convened. That's the day you had, it's like a field hearing or something, on the state of Michigan. And could you tell us who came and what your thinking was and how that happened?
Yeah, this town hall meeting, I mean, the time couldn't have been more perfect. To give you a sense, the town hall meeting was held in Dearborn. Dearborn has about 98,000 people, the 10th largest city in the USA. And it became to be that way, or Dearborn was successful in the past because of the manufacturing industry. I mean, this city screams manufacturing. The world headquarters of Henry Ford is there, Ford Motor Company. You have about, I think, the second largest Islam Arab community outside Middle East. So it's a big city, and not to mention that River Rouge plant is also located in the same place. So it's a big city, and it should be full of optimism. But because of the collapse of the industry, because of the collapse of the manufacturing industry, and that has also brought up other things, you know, the things that we hear a lot nationally is the housing bubble, and how the manufacturing industry or the collapse of the manufacturing industry has greatly affected the pay, and consequently the mortgages business and the housing bubble. But, for example, just yesterday, there were 51 schools in the Detroit area that were shut down. And this includes things like high school, middle schools, and and things like that. So this thing is hitting all over the place. And you should have pessimism. You should have people crying out. But ironically, since we started organizing, going back to 2000, going back to 2004, and now after the election was almost like a proof of principle to us and to everybody who has been following our activity, that you start having actually people who are in this town, you know, a depressed town, who should be very pessimistic, but they have a certain funny mood now. They have a crack of a smile, sort of a hiding smile behind their faces. And you're forced to ask yourself, what is causing these people to show this sort of hidden or not fully realized enthusiasm? And to go to that, that's why we decided to hold the town hall meeting, is because now we had about, you know, 15 to 16 days to mobilize for this thing. And we saw an opportunity just because Christmas was coming, New Year's was coming, and we knew that people might forget what the youth had done previously, which was to organize the election in such a way that the Democrats got in. But we knew that going in that these Democrats didn't necessarily, they will need help. And the help has to come from the population. And we needed to mobilize the population through this period to actually push these Democrats to actually act on the impeachment of Dick Cheney. So the date, the January 4th, was a strategic date that we planned, and it was good. So we decided that we're going to mobilize the whole population. In Detroit, you don't get to see a lot of people passing through the street, and it's not like most people are in their cars. But we found them, and we found them through post offices, and we found them through malls. We found them through door-to-door. We actually started distributing our pamphlet like newspaper boys, you know, throwing around and talking to people and people coming out of the door. But I can't emphasize enough the role of the music that plays in actually organizing people. It's a tool. I know that Paul Gallagher was just saying that people are trying to imitate it, but when it's done right, this music, especially choral music, bel canto style, is completely effective in actually bringing out the sort of the quality of people that you want to talk to, you know, the creative side of people. And we use that. We were marching, and we had very good responses. People actually wanted to speak. When you get them home, a lot of our organizers ended up getting invited in people's houses to discuss longer subjects, and it was clear that most people in Detroit know that there's something that is brewing. There's something that is that we have an opportunity, so to speak, and it just is, you know, it needed to be emphasized that the first thing that we have to do, or the first order of business, has to be the impeachment of Cheney. And throughout our organizing, it was proven time and time again that people do understand that, and they do want the impeachment to carry over. But it's not just the impeachment that they want. People want their lives back. They want some quality of creativity in their own lives through their jobs, through things like that. The meeting on January 4th brought in about 83 people in attendance. It was a very good audience. You know, people were coming with their brothers and sisters, their girlfriends, and people were just bringing people over. We had a number of people who also came that were contacted, were never contacted for a long time, but they through this period of organizing, they come up. We started with the introduction that Sharon gave about sort of to situate the mind of the people that came to the meeting, that Detroit, every time you're in Detroit, you know, it's very ironic because in a time like this where the industry is shutting down, you have something like the Ford Museum, which is, they don't produce anymore. They just shows they shows you the history of what they have been doing. So this was reminded when Sharon was saying that, you know, Detroit used to be the arsenal of democracy, and right now it's just leading in poverty, and reminding them that we have the capabilities of returning back to those kind of ways of actually returning Detroit back into a city again. And then we sang chorus. Now, during chorus, we were singing on the tune of Joy to the World. We actually started with the normal Joy to the World song, and then we switched to our own lyrics. And what happened is that you start seeing people in the audience just very happy, nonetheless, very happy and smiling and agreeing on what we're singing. The presentation was given by Jeff Steinberg, who is sort of intelligence.
Right, he's our EIR counterintelligence expert and close associate of LaRouche.
Mm-hmm. And Bill Roberts, who gave a top-down sort of history on the role of the youth movements that existed in the United States and what this generation's youth movement has to do to get back to that. And the last presentation was given by Merv Fensler.
I think now, you had a UAW leader too, right? Joe Joseph? Did you have?
Yeah, we had, in the attendance, we had all kinds of people that showed up. We had, like you said, Joe Joseph, who represent auto workers, paid auto workers at Ford. We had activists from Democratic Party, Republican Party. We had mothers and sons. It was like a separation of, you know, different generations come together to talk about the problems of the nation. And Jeff Steinberg gave a presentation on what he saw and, you know, what we have been hearing from Ed and Paul on the sort of the mood in Capitol Hill, and emphasizing that, you know, people are really happy that this situation is arriving. And it really sort of started off the conversation. People wanted to ask questions right then and right now. And it was really good.
Let me ask you
that. Something that I wanted to say about the sort of the quality of dialogue that Merv brought in, it really put people to think about themselves, because Merv and Bill addressed sort of the quality of the destruction of Detroit. It's not just caused by the physical destruction, that it was actually the quality of mind. That true joy lies within the bounds of quality of creativity. And true joy is helping to make the world better in a fashion for people of times to come. True joy is building a nation, you know, and people got it. And people left very excited. They took a lot of bundles, about 70 bundles, I think, were taken at the town hall meeting. We raised about $1,000. It was really good.
Well, that's great. I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just going to say, in the remaining 10 minutes we have, it's possible that Ed or Ivan want to cross ask questions here, or, you know, bring out some points. We certainly had a thematic of people becoming optimistic again, even in the midst of this crisis. Do you want to? Is there any question hanging out there? Okay, the one that I had, but this sounds like a downer, but let me just throw it out here as much or as little you want to discuss. But let me ask, in the midst of all this, Paul and Ed, how much do you think that it's dawning on some people, whether it's the people who had the new financial committees or Barney Frank or something, the scale of the historic collapse process that's underway, like these hedge funds scavenging all over the world and buying everything up and shutting it down and creating trillions of debt. What do you think, Paul?
I think they see it, but they don't know what it means at all. They don't have the slightest idea what it means, but they see it in the sense of, for example, they want to stop the takeovers that are now going on in the auto industry, which are private equity funds backing certain airlines to take over other airlines, but it really means the private equity funds are taking over the airlines. Not only in this country, also the Qantas airline, and basically the only airline in Australia, is being taken over by private equity funds. They want to stop that. They know that's connected to the loss of jobs of quality, skill, and better paying jobs in the United States. So they want to stop that process in discrete instances where they can save an industry or, in the case of airlines, a chunk of infrastructure from being ruined. But they don't understand what this overall process means, because it's being talked to death in the media. You have 2 million households that are going to be foreclosed this year and next. You should see a map of Detroit with the foreclosures on it, and you'd really get an idea of the rate at which this is going. 2 million households, 6-7 million people are going to lose their homes to foreclosure between 2006 and 07, just in the subprime markets alone. But the real estate industry, so-called, the banks are putting out the line. Well, this is not so important, because this number of sales of homes is stabilizing, they say. It's not falling so fast. And we don't really care about the price. The price may be going down. The home price may be going down. But the sales are the activity. And therefore, as long as we have those sales, we have the economic activity. We can count it in the GDP. And there's not really much of a problem there. But look at the serious analysts, even within that industry, like there's a report out from Grubb and Ellis now about the dramatic further increases in foreclosures to be expected in 2007. And they say this is going to hit the banks very, very hard. The price of the homes is exactly the basis on which the consumer credit bubble has been based. So if you lose the price, you lose the consumer credit, you lose the it's a crash. Similarly, with the takeovers, there's a tremendous amount of capital available to be loaned to these private equity sharks to take the companies over. They got $1 trillion in loans in 2006 just for hostile takeovers, let alone all the mergers that took place. So they say, okay, there's all that capital there, so this is fine. It indicates economic activity. But every one of these mergers is engaged in shrinking the actual economic activity or infrastructure service of the company that's being taken over, and leading to the default of that company on the huge volumes of debt that is being extended by the banks for these takeovers. That bubble is similarly coming down. And you just have to say that, no, they don't understand the implications of even the things that they want to stop. They don't see the whole picture, not yet. But as I say, there's going to be some serious hearings in the Congress, and we have to change that situation.
Well, Ed, I wanted to ask you, in the midst of all this justifiable partying and optimism and so forth, do you have any impressions from what Paul was describing, or did you... You know, do you think that people grasp, how much they don't grasp this, or how much they do grasp this comes up?
Yeah, it is. It is true that although there is a sentiment towards development, I mean, you see this with the pay-as-you-go thing. It is really, even with certain solution concepts, there's really not the kind of understanding about these matters that LaRouche has, which is why he's important. I mean, you get sometimes just a general lack of understanding, but some of what we ran across is something that we're calling around here the 109ers, which is the axiomatic assumption that you have to work within the bounds of a Republican dominated majority, even though they don't exist anymore. So you have to, you know, have the same habits. A lot of those habits include trying to avoid an actual economic collapse. And the irony is that most of these guys' families were admitting to us what they were going through in their districts.
Oh, so the family members, not the staffer or the congressman,
well,
was more forthcoming?
The people who were most clear about what the congressman actually was thinking, in the case of the new congressman in particular, were not the staffers that they had just hired
right.
in Washington, who barely knew them, but the campaign staffers who had been on their campaign, who had come in for the receptions.
In the districts.
In the districts. And in many cases, the proud father, mother, mother-in-law, father-in-law, sister-in-law, brother-in-law, who were in there holding court and greeting visitors and so on and so forth, would really tell you what these people. And in the case of this one real explosion of impeachment optimism in that one office when Harriet Meyer's resignation was announced, it was all constituents who were there because they had worked hard on the campaign to get the guy elected in the first place. And, you know, you were getting a reading from them of what that congressman would really like to do. Right?
One last thing I will say is that's why this, what we've already done in this week of action coming up in D.C., and LaRouche's webcast, the 11th, is crucial for that. As we shape the environment sort of polarized around LaRouche's webcast, I think you're going to get, I mean, that'll create the added principle. There's one thing to have a good sentiment and good ideas. There's another thing when you actually understand the principles to realize them. And so we're going to concentrate on the latter mission this week leading up to LaRouche's webcast.
Right. And Ivan, that brings up what you were stressing, that you talked about an explosion of recruitment. Ed, you may want to say something, or Joelle, but you have plans, too, for ongoing, there's kind of daily impromptu classes on the new astronomy and work, but you have sessions planned too for, I guess, weekends or what?
Well, I mean, this is the kind of the infinitesimal action of outreach, is that we're always ready to give pedagogical insights, you know, into exactly the kind of, you know, science as LaRouche has presented to our generation. You know, that this is really necessary if we're going to master physical economics. So the idea here is to get contacts in a mindset so that they understand themselves as capable of really coaching and training and helping congressmen make discoveries in the principles of the United States Constitution.
Right. And Ed, you're going to go, you'll be here. So how many people? You'll have a lot here during the current week. Is that right? For the week of action you're expecting tomorrow night?
Yeah, we'll have approximately 70, maybe more, depending on guests who will come down also. And as I said, it's the ambiguity of the moment, which is really going to help us in one respect. Communicate a lot of these creative ideas, because there's no formula that you can really attach to what we need to do. A lot of this is banking on our work around the coursework in the Kepler and deploying to unleash our creative potential. So we're going to concentrate a lot on trying to intersect Congress in ways that are somewhat unorthodox. We assume there'll probably be a lot of parties and things like this. There's going to be some hearings. So there's various ways to shape the situation that we're in the middle of figuring out, and we got a whole bunch of people on top of that. And the people coming down will just add to the degree of creative potential that we're able to launch. So,
well, that closes our hour on the right kind of note. And so I want to thank everyone for this January 6, 2007 LaRouche show. Thank Ivan, Ed, Paul, and Joelle. Listen again January 13th. We are weekly. It's www.larouchepub.com. Happiest of all New Year's. Thank you very much. This is Marcia Mary Baker signing off.